teen books and fantasy I was into reading a few years back. Kids' stories I read 100 times. I pull them down and stack them in the hallway.
You're giving away the books? You love books,
Mummy says. She's coming out of her room wearing fresh clothes for supper. Lipstick.
We can give them to one of the Vineyard libraries, I say. Or to Goodwill.
Mummy bends over and flips through the paperbacks.
We read Charmed Life together. Do you remember?
I nod.
And this one, too. The Lives of Christopher Chant.
That was the year you were 8. You wanted to read everything, but you weren't a good enough reader yet, so I read to you and Gat for hours and hours.
What about Johnny and Mirren?
They couldn't sit still, said Mummy.
Don't you want to keep these?
She reaches out and touches my cheek. I pull back. I want the things to find a better home, I tell her.
I was hoping you would feel different when we came back to the island is all.
You got rid of all Dad's stuff. He bought a new couch, new dishes, new jewelry.
Katie.
There's nothing in our whole house that says he ever lived with us except me. Why are you allowed to erase my father and I'm not allowed to...
Erase yourself? Mummy says.
Other people might use these, I snap, pointing at the stacks of books. People who have actual needs. Don't you think of doing good in the world? At that moment, Poppy, Bosch, and Grendel hurtle upstairs and clog the hallway where we are standing, snarfling our hands, flapping their hairy tails at our knees. Mummy and I are silent. Finally, she says,
It's all right for you to moon around at a tiny beach or whatever you did this afternoon. It's all right for you to give away your books if you feel that strongly. But I expect you at Claremont for supper in an hour with a smile on your face for Granddad. No arguments, no excuses. You understand me?
I nod. Chapter 28. A pad is left from several summers ago when Gad and I got obsessed with graph paper. We made drawing after drawing on it by filling in the tiny squares with colored pencil to make pixelated portraits. I find a pen and write down all my memories of summer 15. The s'mores, the swim, the attic, the interruption, Mirren's hand, her chipped gold nail polish holding a jug of gas for the motorboats, Mummy, her face tight, asking, The black pearls? Johnny's feet running down the stairs from Claremont to the boathouse, Granddad holding onto a tree, his face lit by the glow of a bonfire, and all four of us liars laughing so hard we felt dizzy and sick. I make a separate page for the accident itself, what Mummy's told me and what I guess. I must have gone swimming on the tiny beach alone. I hit my head on a rock. I must have struggled back to shore. Aunt Bess and Mummy gave me tea. I was diagnosed with hypothermia, respiratory problems, and a brain injury that never showed on the scans. I tack the pages to the wall above my bed. I add sticky notes with questions. Why did I go into the water alone at night? Where were my clothes? Did I really have a head injury from the swim, or did something else happen? Could someone have hit me earlier? Was I the victim of some crime? And what happened between me and Gat? Did we argue? Did I wrong him? Did he stop loving me and go back to Raquel? I resolve that everything I learn in the next 4 weeks will go above my Windermere bed. I will sleep beneath the notes and study them every morning. Maybe a picture will emerge from the pixels. A witch has been standing there behind me for some time, waiting for a moment of weakness. She holds an ivory statue of a goose. It is intricately carved. I turn and admire it only for a moment before she swings it with shocking force. It connects, crushing a hole in my forehead. I can feel my bone come loose. The witch swings the statue again and hits above my right ear, smashing my skull. Blow after blow she lands until tiny flakes of bone litter the bed and mingle with chipped bits of her once beautiful goose.
I find my pills and turn off the light. Cadence, Mummy calls from the hallway. Supper is on at New Claremont. I can't go. I can't. I won't. Mommy promises coffee to help me stay awake while the drugs are in my system. She says how long it's been since the aunts have seen me, how the Littles are my cousins, too, after all. I have family obligations. I can only feel the break in my skull and the pain ringing through my brain. Everything else is a faded backdrop to that. Finally, she leaves without me. Chapter 29. Deep in the night, the house rattles. Just the thing Taft was scared of over at Cuddledown. All the houses here do it. They're old, and the island is buffeted by winds off the sea. I try to go back to sleep. No. I go downstairs and onto the porch. My head feels okay now. Aunt Carrie is on the walkway, heading away from me in her nightgown and a pair of shearling boots. She looks skinny, with the bones of her chest exposed and her cheekbones hollow. She turns onto the wooden walkway that leads to Redgate. I sit, staring after her, breathing the night air and listening to the waves. A few minutes later, she comes up the path from Cuddledown again. Katie, she says, stopping and crossing her arms over her chest. You feeling better? Sorry I missed supper, I say. I had a headache. There will be suppers every night, all summer. Can't you sleep? Oh, you know, Carrie scratches her neck. I can't sleep without Ed. Isn't that silly?
No.
I start wandering. It's good exercise. Have you seen Johnny?
Not in the middle of the night.
He's up when I'm up, sometimes. Do you see him?
You could look if his light is on.
Will has such bad nightmares, Carrie says. He wakes up screaming and then I can't go back to sleep.
I shiver in my sweatshirt. Do you want a flashlight? I ask. There's one inside the door.
Oh, no. I like the dark.
She trudges once again up the hill. Chapter 30. Mummy is in the New Claremont kitchen with Granddad. I see them through the glass sliding doors.
You're up early, she says when I come in.
Feeling better? Granddad is wearing a plaid bathrobe. Mummy is in a sundress decorated with small pink lobsters. She is making espresso.
Do you want scones? The cook made bacon, too. They're both in the warming drawer.
She walks across the kitchen and lets the dogs into the house. Bosch, Grendel, and Poppy wag their tails and drool. Mummy bends and wipes their paws with a wet cloth, then absent-mindedly swipes the floor where their muddy paw prints were. They sit stupidly, sweetly.
Where's Fatima? I ask. Where's Prince Philip?
They're gone, says Mummy.
What?
Be nice to her, says Granddad. He turns to me. They passed on a while back.
Both of them?
Granddad nods.
I'm sorry. I sit next to him at the table. Did they suffer?
Not for long.
Mummy brings a plate of raspberry scones and one of bacon to the table. I take a scone and spread butter and honey on it.
She used to be a little blonde girl, a Sinclair through and through,
Granddad complains to Mummy.
We talked about my hair when you came to visit, I remind him.
I don't expect you to like it. Grandfathers never like hair dye.
You're the parent. You should make Mirren change her hair back how it was,
Granddad says to my mother.
What happened to the little blonde girls who used to run around this place?
Mummy sighs. We grew up, Dad, she says. We grew up. Chapter 31. Giveaways. Childhood art, botanic prints.
I get my laundry basket from Windermere and head to Cuddledown. Mirren meets me on the porch, skipping around. "It's so amazing to be on the island," she says. "I can't believe I'm here again."
"You were here last summer."
"It wasn't the same. No summer idol like we used to have. They were doing construction on New Claremont. Everyone was acting miserable, and I kept looking for you, but you never came."
"I told you I was going to Europe."
"Oh, I know."
"I wrote you a lot," I say. It comes out reproachful.
"I hate email," says Mirren. "I read them all, but you can't be mad at me for not answering. It feels like homework, typing and staring at the stupid phone or the computer."
"Did you get the doll I sent you?"
Mirren puts her arms around me. "I missed you so much. You can't even believe how much."
"I sent you that Barbie, the one with the long hair we used to fight over."
"Princess Butterscotch?"
"Yeah."
"I was crazy about Princess Butterscotch."
"You hit me with her once."
"You deserved it."
Mirren jumps around happily.
"Is she at Windermere?"
"What? No. I sent her in the mail," I say, "over the winter." Mirren looks at me, her brows furrowed.
"I never got her, Cadence."
"Someone signed for the package. What did your mom do, shove it in a closet without opening it?" I'm joking, but Mirren nods.
"Maybe. She's compulsive. Like, she scrubs her hands over and over, makes Taft and the twins do it too. Cleans like there's a special place in heaven for people with spotless kitchen floors. Also, she drinks too much."
"Mommy does too."
Mirren nods. "I can't stand to watch."
"Did I miss anything at supper last night?"
"I didn't go."
Mirren heads onto the wooden walkway that leads from Cuddledown to the tiny beach. I follow.
"I told you, I wasn't going this summer."
"Why didn't you come over here?"
"I got sick." "We all know about your migraines," says Mirren. "The ants have been talking."
I flinch. "Don't feel sorry for me, okay? Not ever. It makes my skin crawl."
"Didn't you take your pills last night?"
"They knocked me out." We have reached the tiny beach. Both of us go barefoot across the damp sand. Mirren touches the shell of a long dead crab.
I want to tell her that my memory is hacked, that I have a traumatic brain injury. I want to ask her everything that happened summer 15, make her tell me the stories Mummy doesn't want to talk about or doesn't know. But there's Mirren, so bright. I don't want her to feel more pity for me than she already does. Also, I am still mad about the emails she didn't answer, and the loss of the stupid Barbie, though I'm sure it's not her fault.
"Are Johnny and Gad at Redgate, or did they sleep at Cuddledown?" I ask.
"Cuddledown? God, they're slobs. It's like living with goblins."
"Make them move back to Redgate, then."
"No way," laughs Mirren. "And you, no more Windermere, okay? You'll move in with us?"
I shake my head. "Mommy says no. I asked her this morning."
"Come on, she has to let you."
"She's all over me since I got sick."
"But that's nearly 2 years.
"Yeah, she watches me sleep. Plus, she lectured me about bonding with Granddad and the Littles. I have to connect with the family, put on a smile."
"That's such bullshit."
Mirren shows me a handful of tiny purple rocks she's collected.
"Here."
"No, thanks. I don't want anything I don't need."
"Please take them," says Mirren.
"I remember how you used to always search for purple rocks when we were little." She holds her hand out to me, palm up.
"I want to make up for Princess Butterscotch."
There are tears in her eyes.
"And the emails,"
she adds.
"I want to give you something, Katie."
"Okay, then," I say. I cup my hands and let Mirren pour the rocks into my palms. I store them in the front pocket of my hoodie.
"I love you," she shouts. Then she turns and calls out to the sea. I love my cousin Caden St. Clair Eastman!
Overdoing it much?
It is Johnny padding down the steps with bare feet, dressed in old flannel pajamas with a ticking stripe. He's wearing wraparound sunglasses and white sunblock down his nose like a lifeguard. Mirren's face falls, but only momentarily. I am expressing my feelings, Johnny. That is what being a living, breathing human being is all about. Hello?
Okay, living, breathing human being, he says, biffing her lightly on the shoulder. But there's no need to do it so loudly at the crack of dawn. We have the whole summer in front of us.
She sticks out her bottom lip. Katie's only here 4 weeks.
I can't get ugly with you this early, says Johnny. I haven't had my pretentious tea yet.
He bends and looks in a laundry basket at my feet.
What's in here?
Botanic prints and some of my old art.
How come?
Johnny sits on a rock and I settle next to him. I am giving away my things, I say, since September. Remember I sent you the stripy scarf?
Oh, yeah.
I tell about giving the things to people who can use them, finding the right homes for them. I talk about charity and questioning Mummy's materialism. I want Johnny and Mirren to understand me. I am not someone to pity, with an unstable mind and weird pain syndromes. I am taking charge of my life. I live according to my principles. I take action and make sacrifices.
You don't, I don't know, want to own stuff?
Johnny asks me. Like what?
Oh, I want stuff all the time, says Johnny, throwing his arms wide. A car, video games, expensive wool coats. I like watches. They're so old school. I want real art for my walls, paintings by famous people I could never own in a million years. Fancy cakes I see in bakery windows, sweaters, scarves, woolly items with stripes, generally.
Or you could want beautiful drawings you made when you were a kid, says Mirren, kneeling by the laundry basket. Sentimental stuff. She picks up the crayon drawing of Gran with the Goldens. Look, this one is Fatima and this one is Prince Philip.
You can tell?
Of course. Fatima had that chubby nose and wide face.
God, Mirren, you're such a mushball, Johnny says.
Chapter 32. Gat calls my name as I am heading up the walkway to New Claremont. I turn and he's running at me, wearing blue pajama pants and no shirt. Gat. My Gat. Is he going to be my Gat? He stops in front of me, breathing hard. His hair sticks up, bedhead. The muscles of his abdomen ripple, and he seems much more naked than he would in a swimsuit.
Johnny said you were down at the tiny beach, he pants. I looked for you there first.
Did you just wake up? He rubs the back of his neck, looks down at what he's wearing.
Kind of. I wanted to catch you.
How come?
Let's go to the perimeter.
We head there and walk the way we did as children, Gad in front and me behind. We crest a low hill, then curve back behind the staff building to where the Vineyard Harbor comes into view near the boathouse. Gat turns so suddenly I nearly run into him, and before I can step back, his arms are around me. He pulls me to his chest and buries his face in my neck. I wrap my bare arms around his torso, the insides of my wrist against his spine. He is warm.
I didn't get to hug you yesterday,
Gat whispers.
Everyone hugged you but me.
Touching him is familiar and unfamiliar. We have been here before. Also, we have never been here before. For a moment, or for minutes, for hours possibly. I am simply happy here with Gat's body beneath my hands. The sound of the waves and his breath in my ear. Glad that he wants to be near me.
Do you remember when we came down here together?
He asks into my neck.
The time we went out on that flat rock.
I step away, because I don't remember. I hate my fucking hacked-up mind. How sick I am all the time. How damaged I've become. I hate that I've lost my looks and failed school and quit sports and am cruel to my mother. I hate how I still want him after 2 years. Maybe Gat wants to be with me. Maybe. But more likely he's just looking for me to tell him he did nothing wrong when he left me 2 summers ago. He'd like me to tell him I'm not mad, that he's a great guy. But how can I forgive him when I don't even know exactly what he's done to me? No, I answer. It must have slipped my mind.
We were... You and I... We... It was an important moment.
Whatever, I say. I don't remember it. And obviously nothing that happened between us was particularly important in the long run, was it? He looks at his hands.
Okay, sorry. That was extremely suboptimal of me just now. Are you angry?
Of course I'm angry, I say. 2 years of disappearance, never calling and not writing back, and making everything worse by not dealing? Now you're all, ooh, I thought I'd never see you again, and holding my hand, and everyone hugs you but me, and half-naked perimeter walking. It's severely suboptimal, Gat, if that's the word you want to use. His face falls.
It sounds awful when you put it that way.
Yeah, well, that's how I see it. He rubs his hand on his hair.
I'm handling everything badly, he says. What would you say if I asked you to start over?
God, Gat.
What?
Just ask. Don't ask what I'd say if you did ask.
Okay, I'm asking. Can we start over? Please, Katie. Let's start over after lunch. It'll be awesome. I'll make amusing remarks and you'll laugh. We'll go troll hunting. We'll be happy to see each other. You'll think I'm great. I promise.
That's a big promise.
Okay, maybe not great, but at least I won't be suboptimal.
Why say suboptimal? Why not say what you really are? Thoughtless and confusing and manipulative.
God!
Gat jumps up and down in agitation. Cadence! I really need to just start over. This is going from suboptimal down to total crap. He jumps and kicks his legs out like an angry little boy. The jumping makes me smile. Okay, I tell him. Start over. After lunch.
All right,
he says, and stops jumping.
After lunch.
We stare at each other for a moment.
I'm going to run away now, says Gat. Don't take it personally.
Okay.
It's better for the starting over if I run, because walking will just be awkward.
I said okay.
Okay then.
And he runs. Chapter 33. I go to lunch at New Claremont an hour later. I know Mummy will not tolerate my absence after I missed supper last night. Granddad gives me a tour of the house while the cook sets out food and the aunts corral the littles. It's a sharp place. Shining wood floors, huge windows, everything low to the ground. The halls of Claremont used to be decorated floor to ceiling with black and white family photographs, paintings of dogs, bookshelves, and Granddad's collection of New Yorker cartoons. New Claremont's halls are glass on one side and blank on the other. Granddad opens the doors to the 4 guest bedrooms upstairs. All are furnished only with beds and low, wide dressers. The windows have white shades that let some light shine in. There are no patterns on the bedspreads. They are simple, tasteful shades of blue or brown. The littles' rooms have some life.
Taft has a Bakugan arena on the floor, a soccer ball, books about wizards and orphans. Liberty and Bonnie brought magazines and an MP3 player. They have stacks of Bonnie's books on ghost hunters, psychics, and dangerous angels. Their dresser is cluttered with makeup and perfume bottles, tennis rackets in the corner. Granddad's bedroom is larger than the others and has the best view. He takes me in and shows me the bathroom, which has handles in the shower. Old person handles so he won't fall down. "Where are your New Yorker cartoons?" I ask.
"The decorator made decisions."
"What about the pillows?"
"The what?"
"You had all those pillows with embroidered dogs." He shakes his head. "Did you keep the fish?"
"What? The swordfish and all that?"
We walk down the staircase to the ground floor. Granddad moves slowly, and I am behind him.
"I started over with this house,"
he says simply.
"That old life is gone."
He opens the door to his study. It's as severe as the rest of the house. A laptop sits in the center of a large desk. A large window looks out over the Japanese garden. A chair, a wall of shelves, completely empty. It feels clean and open, but it isn't Spartan because everything is opulent. Granddad is more like Mommy than like me. He's erased his old life by spending money on a replacement one.
"Where's the young man?"
asks Granddad suddenly. His face takes on a vacant look. "Johnny?" He shakes his head.
"No, no."
"Gat?"
"Yes, the young man."
He clutches the desk for a moment, as if feeling faint. "Granddad, are you okay?"
"Oh, fine."
"Gat is at Cuddledown with Mirren and Johnny," I tell him.
"There was a book I promised him."
"Most of your books aren't here."
"Stop telling me what's not here!"
Granddad yells, suddenly forceful. "You okay?" It is Aunt Carrie standing in the door of the study.
"I'm all right,"
he says. Carrie gives me a look and takes Granddad's arm. "Come on, lunch is ready." "Did you get back to sleep?" I ask my aunt as we head toward the kitchen. "Last night? Was Johnny up?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," she says.
Chapter 34. Granddad's cook does the shopping and preps the meals, but the aunties plan all the menus. Today we have cold roast chicken, tomato basil salad, camembert, baguettes, and strawberry lemonade in the dining room. Liberty shows me pictures of cute boys in a magazine. Then she shows me pictures of clothes in another magazine. Bonnie reads a book called Collective Apparitions, Fact and Fiction. Taft and Will want me to take them tubing, drive the small motorboat while they float behind it in an inner tube. Mummy says I'm not allowed to drive the boat on meds. Aunt Carrie says that doesn't matter because no way is Will going tubing. Aunt Bess says she agrees, so Taft better not even think about asking her. Liberty and Bonnie ask if they can go tubing.
"You always let Mirren go," says Liberty. "You know it's true."
Will spills his lemonade and soaks a baguette. Granddad's lap gets wet. Taft gets hold of the wet baguette and hits Will with it. Mummy wipes the mess while Bess runs upstairs to bring Granddad clean trousers. Carrie scolds the boys. When the meal is over, Taft and Will duck into the living room to avoid helping with the cleanup. They jump like lunatics on Granddad's new leather couch. I follow. Will is runty and pink like Johnny, hair almost white. Taft is taller and very thin, golden and freckled, with long dark lashes and a mouth full of braces.
"So, you two," I say, "how was last summer?"
"Do you know how to get an ash dragon in Dragonvale?" asks Will.
"I know how to get a scorch dragon," says Taft.
"You can use the scorch dragon to get the ash dragon," says Will.
Ugh, 10-year-olds.
"Come on, last summer," I say. "Tell me." Did you play tennis?
Sure,
says Will. Did you go swimming?
Yeah,
says Taft. Did you go boating with Gad and Johnny? They both stop jumping.
No.
Did Gad say anything about me?
I'm not supposed to talk about you ending up in the water and everything, says Will. I promised Aunt Penny I wouldn't.
Why not? I ask.
It'll make your headaches worse, and we have to leave the subject alone.
Taft nods.
She said if we make your headaches worse, she'll string us up by our toenails and take away the iPads. We're supposed to act cheerful and not be idiots.
This isn't about my accident, I say. This is about the summer when I went to Europe.
Katie?
Taft touches my shoulder.
Bonnie saw pills in your bedroom.
Will backs away and sits on the far arm of the sofa. Bonnie went through my stuff?
And Liberty.
God!
You told me you weren't a drug addict, but you have pills on your dresser.
Taft is petulant. Tell them to stay out of my room, I say.
If you're a drug addict, says Taft, there's something you need to know.
What?
Drugs are not your friend.
Taft looks serious.
Drugs are not your friend. And also, people should be your friends.
Oh, my God. Would you just tell me what you did last summer, Pipsqueak? Will says,
Taft and I want to play Angry Birds. We don't want to talk to you anymore.
Whatever, I say.
Go and be free.
I step onto the porch and watch the boys as they run down the path to Redgate. Chapter 35. All the windows in Cuddledown are open when I come down after lunch. Gad is putting music on the ancient CD player. My old crayon art is on the refrigerator with magnets. Dad on top, Gran and the Goldens on the bottom. My painting is taped to one of the kitchen cupboards. A ladder and a big box of gift wrap stand in the center of the great room. Mirren pushes an armchair across the floor. I never liked the way my mother kept this place, she explains. I help Gad and Johnny move the furniture around until Mirren is happy. We take down Bess's landscape watercolors and roll up her rugs. We pillage the littles' bedrooms for fun objects. When we are done, the great room is decorated with piggy banks and patchwork quilts, stacks of children's books, a lamp shaped like an owl. Thick, sparkling ribbons from the gift wrap box crisscross the ceiling. Won't Bess be mad you're redecorating? I ask. I promise you she's not setting foot in Cuddledown for the rest of the summer. She's been trying to get out of this place for years. What do you mean?
Oh, says Mirren lightly. You know, natter, natter, least favorite daughter, natter, natter, the kitchen is such crap. Why won't Granddad remodel it, etc.?
Did she ask him? Johnny stares at me oddly.
You don't remember?
Her memory is messed up, Johnny, yells Mirren. She doesn't remember, like, half our summer 15.
She doesn't, Johnny says. I thought...
No! No! Shut up right now, Mirren barks. Did you not listen to what I told you?
When?
He looks perplexed.
The other night, says Mirren. I told you what Aunt Penny said.
Chill, says Johnny, throwing a pillar at her.
This is important. How can you not pay attention to this stuff?
Mirren looks like she might cry.
I'm sorry, all right?
Johnny says.
Gat, did you know about Cadence not remembering, like, most of the summer 15?
I knew, he says.
See?
Says Mirren.
Gat was listening.
My face is hot. I am looking at the floor. No one speaks for a minute. It's normal to lose some memory when you hit your head really hard, I say finally. Did my mother explain? Johnny laughs nervously. I'm surprised Mummy told you, I go on. She hates talking about it. She said you're supposed to take it easy and remember things in your own time. All the aunties know, says Mirren. Granddad knows, the littles, the staff. Every single person on the island knows, but Johnny, apparently.
I knew, says Johnny. I just didn't know the whole picture.
Don't be feeble, says Mirren. Now is really not the time.
It's okay, I say to Johnny. You're not feeble. You merely had a suboptimal moment. I'm sure you'll be optimal from now on.
I'm always optimal, says Johnny. Just not the kind of optimal Mirren wants me to be.
Gat smiles when I say the word suboptimal and pats my shoulder. We have started over. Chapter 36. We play tennis. Johnny and I win, but not because I'm any good anymore. He's an excellent athlete, and Mirren is more inclined to hit the ball and then do happy dances without caring whether it's returning. Gat keeps laughing at her, which makes him miss.
How was Europe?
Asks Gat as we walk back to cuddle down. My father eats squid ink.
What else?
We reach the yard and toss the rackets on the porch, stretch ourselves out on the grass. Honestly, I can't tell you that much, I say. Know what I did while my dad went to the Coliseum?
What?
I lay with my face pressed into the tile of the hotel bathroom, stared at the base of the blue Italian toilet.
The toilet was blue?
Johnny asks, sitting up.
Only you would get more excited over a blue toilet than the sights of Rome, moans Gat.
Cadence? What? Never mind.
What?
You say you don't feel sorry for you, but then you tell a story about the base of the toilet, she blurts. It's seriously pitiful. What are we supposed to say?
Also, going to Rome makes us jealous, says Gat. None of us has been to Rome. I want to go to Rome, says Johnny, lying back down. I want to see the blue Italian toilet so bad. I want to see the baths of Caracalla, says Gat, and eat every flavor of gelato they make.
So go, I say.
It's hardly that simple.
Okay, but you will go, I say, in college or after college. Gat sighs.
I'm just saying, you went to Rome.
I wish you could have been there, I tell him. Chapter 37. Were you on the tennis court? Mummy asks me. I heard balls.
Just messing around.
You haven't played in so long. That's wonderful. My serve is off. I'm so happy you're taking it up again. If you want to volley with me tomorrow, say the word.
She is delusional. I am not taking up tennis again just because I played one single afternoon, and in no capacity do I ever want to volley with Mummy.
She will wear a tennis skirt and praise me, and caution me and hover over me until I'm unkind to her.
We'll see, I say. I probably strain my shoulder.
Supper is outside in the Japanese garden. We watch the 8 o'clock sunset in groups around the small tables. Taft and Will grab pork chops off the platter and eat them with their hands.
You two are animals, says Liberty, wrinkling her nose.
And your point is, says Taft.
There's a thing called a fork, says Liberty.
There's a thing called your face, says Taft.
Johnny, Gat, and Mirren get to eat at Cuddle Down because they aren't invalids, and their mothers aren't controlling. Mummy doesn't even let me sit with the adults. She makes me sit at a separate table with my cousins. They're all laughing and sniping at each other, talking with their mouths full. I stop listening to what they are saying. Instead, I look across to Mummy, Carrie, and Bess, clustered around Granddad. There is a night I remember now.
It must have been about 2 weeks before my accident. Early July. We were all sitting at the long table on the Claremont lawn. Citronella candles burned on the porch. The Littles had finished their burgers and were doing cartwheels on the grass. The rest of us were eating grilled swordfish with basil sauce. There was a salad of yellow tomatoes and a casserole of zucchini with a crust of Parmesan cheese. Gat pressed his leg against mine under the table. I felt lightheaded with happiness. The ants toyed with their food, silent and formal with one another beneath the Littles' shouts. Grandad leaned back, folding his hands over his abdomen.
"You think I should renovate the Boston house?"
he asked. A silence followed.
"No, Dad,"
Bess was the first to speak.
"We love that house."
"You always complain about drafts in the living room,"
said Grandad. Bess looked around at her sisters.
"I don't."
"You don't like the decor," said Grandad.
"That's true." Mummy's voice was critical.
"I think it's timeless," said Carrie. "I could use your advice, you know," Grandad said to Bess. "Would you come over and look at it carefully? Tell me what you think."
He leaned in.
"I could sell it, too, you know."
We all knew Aunt Bess wanted the Boston house. All the aunts wanted the Boston house. It was a $4 million house, and they grew up in it. But Bess was the only one who lived nearby, and the only one with enough kids to fill the bedrooms.
"Dad," Carrie said sharply, "you can't sell it."
"I can do what I want,"
said Grandad, spearing the last tomato on his plate and popping it in his mouth.
"You like the house as it is then, Bess? Or do you want to see it remodeled? No one likes a waffler."
"I'd love to help with whatever you want to change, Dad."
"Oh, please," snapped Mummy. "Only yesterday you were saying how busy you are, and now you're helping remodel the Boston house?"
"He asked for our help," said Bess.
"He asked for your help."
"You cutting us out, Dad?"
Mummy was drunk. Grandad laughed.
"Penny, relax."
"I'll relax when the estate is settled."
"You're making us crazy," Carrie muttered.
"What was that? Don't mumble."
"We all love you, Dad," said Carrie loudly. "I know it's been hard this year."
"If you're going crazy, it's your own damn choice," said Grandad. "Pull yourself together. I can't leave the estate to crazy people."
Look at the aunties now. Summer 17. Here in the Japanese garden of New Claremont. Mummy has her arm around Bess, who reaches out to slice Carrie a piece of raspberry tart. It's a beautiful night, and we are indeed a beautiful family. I do not know what changed. Chapter 38. Taft has a motto, I tell Mirren. It is midnight. We liars are playing Scrabble in the cuddle-down great room. My knee is touching Gat's thigh, though I'm not sure he notices. The board is nearly full. My brain is tired. I have bad letters. Mirren rearranges her tiles distractedly.
"Taft has what?"
"A motto," I say. "You know, like Grandad has. No one likes a waffler."
"Never take a seat in the back of the room," intones Mirren.
"Never complain, never explain," says Gat. "That's from Disraeli, I think."
"Oh, he loves that one," says Mirren.
"And don't take no for an answer," I add.
"Good Lord, Katie," shouts Johnny. "Will you just build a word and let the rest of us get on with it?"
"Don't yell at her, Johnny," says Mirren.
"Sorry," says Johnny. "Will you pretty please with brown sugar and cinnamon make a fucking Scrabble word?"
My knee is touching Gat's thigh. I really can't think.
I make a short, lame word. Johnny plays his tiles. Drugs are not your friend, I announce. That's Taft's motto.
Get out, laughs Mirren. Where did he come up with that?
Maybe he had drug education at school. Plus, the twins snooped in my room and told him I had a dresser full of pills, so he wanted to make sure I'm not an addict.
God, said Mirren. Bonnie and Liberty are disasters. I think they're kleptomaniacs now.
Really?
They took my mom's sleeping pills and also her diamond hoops. I have no idea where they think they'll wear those earrings where she wouldn't see them. Also, they are two people and it's only one pair.
Did you call them on it?
I tried with Bonnie, but they're beyond my help, Mirren says. She rearranges her tiles again. I like the idea of a motto, she goes on. I think an inspirational quote can get you through hard times.
Like what? Asks Gat.
Mirren pauses. Then she says, be a little kinder than you have to. We are all silenced by that.
It seems impossible to argue with. Then Johnny says, never eat anything bigger than your ass.
You ate something bigger than your ass? I ask.
He nods, solemn.
Okay, Gat, says Mirren. What's yours?
Don't have one.
Come on.
Okay. Maybe.
Gat looks down at his fingernails.
Do not accept an evil you can change.
I agree with that, I say. Because I do. I don't, says Mirren.
Why not?
There's very little you can change. You need to accept the world as it is.
Not true, says Gat.
Isn't it better to be a relaxed, peaceful person? Mirren asks.
No, Gat is decisive. It is better to fight evil. Don't eat yellow snow, says Johnny. That's another good motto.
Always do what you are afraid to do, I say. That's mine.
Oh, please. Who the hell says that? Barks Mirren.
Emerson, I answer. I think. I reach for a pen and write it on the backs of my hands. Left. Always do what, right, you are afraid to do. The handwriting is skewed on the right.
Emerson is so boring, says Johnny.
He grabs the pen from me and writes on his own left hand. No yellow snow.
There, he says, holding the result up for display. That should help.
Katie, I'm serious. We should not always do what we are afraid to do, says Mirren heatedly. We never should.
Why not?
You could die. You could get hurt. If you are terrified, there's probably a good reason. You should trust your impulses.
So what's your philosophy then? Johnny asks her. Be a giant chicken head?
Yes, says Mirren. That, and the kindness thing I said before. Chapter 39. I follow Gat when he goes upstairs. I chase after him down the long hall, grab his hand and pull his lips to mine. It is what I am afraid to do, and I do it. He kisses me back. His fingers twine in mine, and I'm dizzy, and he's holding me up, and everything is clear, and everything is grand again. Our kiss turns the world to dust. There is only us, and nothing else matters. Then Gat pulls away.
I shouldn't do this.
Why not? His hand still holds mine.
It's not that I don't want to. It's...
I thought we started over. Isn't this the starting over?
I'm a mess.
Gat steps back and leans against the wall.
This is such a cliché conversation. I don't know what else to say.
Explain. A pause, and then...
You don't know me.
Explain, I say again. Gat puts his head in his hands. We stand there, both leaning against the wall in the dark.
Okay, here's part of it, he finally whispers. You've never met my mom. You've never been to my apartment.
That's true. I've never seen Gat anywhere but Beechwood.
You feel like you know me, Katie, but you only know the me who comes here, he says. It's just not the whole picture. You don't know my bedroom with the window onto the air shaft, my mom's curry, the guys from school, the way we celebrate holidays. You only know the me on this island, where everyone's rich except me and the staff, where everyone's white except me, Ginny, and Paolo.
Who are Ginny and Paolo? Gat hits his fist into his palm.
Ginny is the housekeeper. Paolo is the gardener. You don't know their names, and they've worked here summer after summer. That's part of my point.
My face heats with shame. I'm sorry.
But do you even want to see the whole picture? Gat asks. Could you even understand it?
You won't know unless you try me, I say. I haven't heard from you in forever.
You know what I am to your grandfather. What I've always been.
What?
Heathcliff, in Wuthering Heights. Have you read it?
I shake my head.
Heathcliff is a gypsy boy taken in and raised by this pristine family, the Earnshaws. Heathcliff falls in love with the girl, Catherine. She loves him too, but she also thinks he's dirt because of his background, and the rest of the family agrees.
That's not how I feel.
There's nothing Heathcliff can ever do to make these Earnshaws think he's good enough, and he tries. He goes away, educates himself, becomes a gentleman. Still, they think he's an animal.
And?
Then, because the book is a tragedy, Heathcliff becomes what they think of him. You know, he becomes a brute. The evil in him comes out.
I heard it was a romance. Gat shakes his head.
Those people are awful to each other.
You're saying Granddad thinks you're Heathcliff?
I promise you he does, says Gat. A brute beneath a pleasant surface, betraying his kindness in letting me come to his sheltered island every year. I've betrayed him by seducing his Catherine, his Cadence. And my penance is to become the monster he always saw in me.
I am silent. Gat is silent. I reach out and touch him. Just the feel of his forearm beneath the thin cotton of his shirt makes me ache to kiss him again.
You know what's terrifying?
Gat says, not looking at me.
What's terrifying is... he's turned out to be right.
No, he hasn't.
Oh, yes, he has.
Gat, wait. But he has gone into his room and shut the door. I am alone in the dark hallway. Chapter 40. Once upon a time, there was a king who had three beautiful daughters. The girls grew up as lovely as the day was long. They made grand marriages, too. The arrival of the first grandchild brought disappointment. The youngest princess produced a daughter so very, very tiny that her mother took to keeping her in a pocket where the girl went unnoticed. Eventually, normal-sized grandchildren arrived, and the king and queen forgot the existence of the tiny princess almost completely. When the two small princesses grew older, she passed most of her days and nights hardly ever leaving her tiny bed. There was very little reason for her to get up, so solitary was she. One day, she ventured to the palace library and was delighted to find what good company books could be. She began going there often. One morning, as she read, a mouse appeared on the table. He stood upright and wore a small velvet jacket. His whiskers were clean and his fur was brown.
"You read just as I do," he said, walking back and forth across the pages.
He stepped forward and made a low bow. The mouse charmed the tiny princess with stories of his adventures. He told her of trolls who steal people's feet and gods who abandon the poor. He asked questions about the universe and searched continually for answers. He thought wounds needed attention. In turn, the princess told the mouse fairy tales, drew him pixelated portraits, and made him little crayon drawings. She laughed and argued with him. She felt awake for the first time in her life. It was not long before they loved each other dearly. When she presented her suitor to her family, however, the princess met with difficulty.
"He is only a mouse!" cried the king in disdain, while the queen screamed and ran from the throne room in fear.
Indeed, the entire kingdom, from royalty to servants, viewed the mouse suitor with suspicion and discomfort.
"He is unnatural," people said of him, "an animal masquerading as a person."
The tiny princess did not hesitate. She and the mouse left the palace and traveled far, far away. In a foreign land, they were married, made a home for themselves, filled it with books and chocolate, and lived happily ever after. If you want to live where people are not afraid of mice, you must give up living in palaces. Chapter 41. A giant wields a rusty saw. He gloats and hums as he works, slicing through my forehead and into the mind behind it. I have less than 4 weeks to find out the truth. Granddad calls me Mirren. The twins are stealing sleeping pills and diamond earrings. Mummy argued with the aunts over the Boston house. Bess hates cuddle down. Carrie roams the island at night. Will has bad dreams. Gat is Heathcliff. Gat thinks I do not know him. And maybe he is right. I take pills, drink water. The room is dark. Mummy stands in the doorway watching me. I do not speak to her. I am in bed for 2 days. Every now and then the sharp pain wanes to an ache. Then, if I am alone, I sit up and write on the cluster of notes above my bed. Questions more than answers. The morning I feel better, Granddad comes over to Windermere early. He's wearing white linen pants and a blue sport jacket. I am in shorts and a t-shirt, throwing balls for the dogs in the yard. Mummy is already up at New Claremont.
"I'm heading to Edgartown," Granddad says, scratching Bosch's ears. "You want to come? If you don't mind an old man's company."
"I don't know," I joke. "I am so busy with these spit-covered tennis balls. Could be all day."
"I'll take you to the bookstore, Katie. Buy you presents like I used to."
"How about fudge?" Granddad laughs.
"Sure, fudge."
"Did Mommy put you up to this?"
"No."
He scratches his tufty white hair.
"But Bess doesn't want me driving the motorboat alone. She says I could get disoriented."
"I'm not allowed to drive the motorboat either."
"I know,"
he says, holding up the keys.
"But Bess and Penny aren't boss here. I am."
We decide to eat breakfast in town. We want to get the boat away from the Beechwood dock before the ants catch us. Edgartown is a nautical sweetie pie village on Martha's Vineyard. It takes 20 minutes to get there. It's all white picket fences and white wooden homes with flowery yards. Shops sell tourist stuff, ice cream, pricey clothes, antique jewelry. Boats leave from the harbor for fishing trips and scenic cruises. Granddad seems like his